Good evening. Welcome to the Celerity Report. Today is March 6, 2014. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Upcoming events, to remind, May 3rd, we're going to have a joint lunch with Going Organics magazine, Lunch with Catherine in Palm Springs, California. That is going to be a good one. We will post it up on the blog as soon as we have the final arrangements done on the venue. I think it's going to be a good one. Our theme tonight is The Ducks Are Squawking, and this is a blast from the past. Luis Mendez came to this country as a young Cuban refugee and had dreams of a legal career in Cuba destroyed. Instead, he worked his way up through the back offices of Morgan Stanley, rising to build the Capital Markets Group. He was recruited to run the Capital Markets Group at Dillon Reed, where when I worked at the firm. And when the market was booming and investors were screaming for product they could buy, he would boom in his thick Cuban accent, "The ducks are squawking, I must feed them." And so it is in the developed world right now. The S&P has risen to even higher PEs. The European markets have moved up a little bit. And it is also a very important election year. And with this rise in the markets, you hear the squawking sound of investors and corporate executives and bankers all seeking ways of maintaining and growing corporate earnings, and that's in the face of slower growth throughout the developed world. Typically, in a non-presidential election year, that's a quieter kind of election. Not this time. This is building up to be a very fierce election competition. Congress is going home to face some very angry constituents. You have now over 100 million Americans receiving mean-tested subsidy. That's food stamps. That's unemployment compensation. We see the latest battle over extending the long-term unemployment compensation. That's welfare. It's all the mean-tested subsidies. And that's because household incomes are falling. The middle class has been squeezed. The labor force participation rate has reached a 35-year low at 63%. So free trade agreements, trillions missing from the government, bailouts, Obamacare, there's a lot to be angry about. The loss on gun control has sent a very clear message. What it says is all the money on the planet cannot buy everything. You cannot fool all the people all of the time. We see Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid pull the rug out from under the president after the State of the Union, saying, you know, I'm not going to play on any trade agreements. And that's because the Democrats are very concerned about losing the Senate. They're only six seats ahead. The Republicans think they can make real progress. And so you're going to see a real fight on the ground, seat by seat, for the Republicans trying to get those six Senate seats. And it's, you know, it's March. It's not even, we haven't even changed to daylight saving times, and already the fight is very heated. So control of Congress right now is more serious than it's ever been. And that's because with the financial coup d'etat behind us, the serious reengineering of the federal budget and the credit mechanism is on the way. And we're down to muscle. There's no more fat. You know, now you're talking about powerful people having to steal from powerful people. So the reengineering of the federal budget and credit mechanism is a real fight, and the breakaways want a clear path to rock and roll. So, you know, who controls that mechanism during this period is going to be very, very important. So it makes the election a very sensitive issue. So control of Congress is serious. Well, what does this mean? With the S&P rising ever higher, the corporations are screaming for income. And what do they want their congressmen? Their congressmen can't deliver them a government check or a government purchase. Then what the government can help them do is help them slice out, you know, the assets around the world that can help bolster their earnings. We said at the beginning of the year, The Economist was saying, you know, what's the next game? Privatization. Well, this is the face of privatization. So literally what you do is you look around the world and you see what are the places in the world where income and assets are trading at low PEs, that's price earnings ratio, or no PEs because they're not securitized, and where the locals are not quote unquote fully exploiting the assets themselves and don't have the military and intelligence power to protect what they have. So they're vulnerable to the machinations of others. So this is our old friend, the tapeworm. If you haven't read my article, The American Tapeworm, and it was one I first introduced the concept, but the tapeworm is hungry and it's on the hunt. And that's what's going on in Ukraine. We see the centralized powers looking to enrich their hungry tapeworm systems by whacking up the Ukraine's assets. We have the members of the G7, particularly the U.S. and Russia. But Europe and China are in there as well, and they're leading the dance to kind of slice up the Ukraine, each to feed to their various ducks. Whatever politicians feed the ducks the most will win. And don't for a minute think that, you know, they're different ducks on different sides. If I'm a corporation, if Putin will give me the most, I'll take it from him. If Obama will give me the most, I'll take it from him. So we have the investors probably on both sides of the fence. Whatever happens, the Ukraine people will lose and probably lose quite badly. In one sense, think of the dance you're watching in the Ukraine as a dance between sovereign nations fronting for factions of investors who control high PE capital and the military intelligence capacity to protect it versus those who don't. So the centralization of ownership and control of assets is proceeding in a very brutal fashion, and unfortunately shrinking wealth as it goes. So money in markets, Ukraine is the top story globally this week. And it, you know, think of the old watchword when you talk about real estate, it's all about location, location, location. And if you look at the Ukraine, its strategic location between Russia, China, the warm water ports of the Black Sea, and Europe is very, very important. It's one of the great breadbaskets of the world. That breadbasket was harmed by the Chernobyl incident in the 80s. But it's one of the great breadbaskets of the world. It's also a transportation point for a lot of oil and gas. The Russian state-controlled company sells about 160 billion cubic meters of natural gas to Europe every year. That's about 25% of the European demand. Half of that travels through the Ukraine pipelines. The Brzezinski wrote a book published in the late 90s called The Grand Chessboard and describes sort of the next struggle as the struggle for Eurasia. It's a very good description, and of course, Ukraine is right in the middle of it. Last November, the Ukraine, at the last minute, refused to sign an EU association agreement that would have drawn the Ukraine closer to the European Union. The Russians were very opposed, Putin wanting to draw them into his Eastern European Trade Association. In December, they then signed a treaty of cooperation with the Chinese. So, of course, the U.S. became stronger and stronger in terms of the soft weapons they were applying in the midst of all of this. And so you sort of have the EU and the U.S. lined up and dancing vis-a-vis the Russians and the Chinese. And, of course, you know, it's just too much attention for 44 million people of the Ukraine. Charles Hugh Smith wrote a great piece. It's up on the blog about the use of soft weapons by the Americans and how not to underestimate those. Yes, the Russians are right next door and can use their navy to block the Ukrainians and to prop down in the Crimea. At the same time, the American soft weapons in this situation are formidable. And another great benefit of the Snowden revelations, of course, Snowden being up in Moscow, supposedly, is that we can start to now understand those soft weapons, but Ukraine will be a place where we can watch them applied with fury. And it's really worth understanding them in that context, because once you see them in another place, this clearly you can start to understand how they are applied in the United States as well. One of the tactics that Smith mentions is the fact that many Russian officials have offshore accounts, and with our sort of attacking and asserting control of the offshore accounts, what we can do vis-a-vis their offshore accounts and threatening their offshore accounts. And he gives some very good examples of the kind of soft weapons that could be play. Just as background, one thing to understand is that in the beginning of the 90s, Russia, Poland, and the Ukraine all had approximately $5,000 to $6,000 per person GDP on average. Poland and Russia have increased their per person GDP about 400%. The Ukraine is not. They're just up a little bit, say 7,000. So they have not kept up with their neighbors and they have not kept up with inflation. And you wonder why, given the importance of their location and the resources they have. I suspect one of the reasons is Chernobyl. Having an event like that in the 80s could be very detrimental to a lot of your economic activity for obvious reasons. The rape of Russia and what happened with U.S. intelligence interests moving into Russia and kind of raping the place could certainly have reverberated into Ukraine. 2 days ago, their bonds were yielding 46%. What that means is they're shut out of the financial markets. And that's part of what happens when you want to force somebody to sell their assets. And of course, literally at the same time, it's announced that they are contemplating privatizing their oil and gas assets. They have a lot of other valuable assets, of course, including the farmland. This is how disaster capitalism works. I posted in the commentary on the Ukraine some of the links to, for example, Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine. But essentially what we're going to see now is the private investment syndicates and large companies, whether Russian, European, or U.S., are going to start winning and picking up assets. And how this dance is going to go, I think it's very fluid, and we'll just have to see how it evolves. There's oil and gas at stake, as I said, farmland, the Black Sea ports, which the Russians have absolute strategic interests. There's no way they're going to let those go. You have steel as well. All of these are in play. And of course, the private interests will win, and the taxpayers, Russian and American and EU, will pay the cost of having the fight, and the Ukraine people will lose and pay mightily. The U.S. markets are up, and the Russian stock market is way down. So if anything, the markets are really sort of demanding the fight, but at the same time, they're tempering it too, because to the extent that the Russians and the Americans and the EU get played off against each other, the market won't tolerate a fight that's bad for the markets, because ultimately what this is about is what's good for the investors, whether we like it or not. There's now a proposal said to be from the Russians to the IMF, insisting that the IMF proceed without a U.S. veto. The Congress has refused to support changes at the IMF going forward. I posted the article up on the blog. You can see the details. So this sort of squabble is going to fight out or move out to the G7. Expect this to continue to happen in other places. Again, as the more powerful centralized systems keep looking to eat up more and more assets of those places that can't translate them into the market valuations that the other centralized systems can. The brutality of the game has upset more than a few commentators. We see Paul Craig Roberts publishing articles called "The End Is Near." I hate to say this. This is disaster capitalism has been playing out for decades now. And unfortunately, as I said, the big problem is it shrinks wealth in the interests of centralizing it. And so it doesn't feel like market or laws. It feels like mob wars for now. If you haven't seen the movie, George Clooney's movie, Syriana, I would really recommend you watch it, because it does a good job of sort of describing the dance between the Russians, the Chinese, and the Americans, in that case in the Middle East, but it's spread to Eurasia now. Back stateside, as I said, unemployment is much greater than many sort of commentators were saying they expected. Certainly not more than we expected here on the Solaria report, and anger is growing. And as I said, this is going to make the elections in November much more serious than the usual congressional cycle. Article up on the blog. There's lots to be angry about. The 26 top American corporations paid no federal income tax from 2008 to 2012. We're sure that contributed to earnings holding up the Standard & Poor's index. One of the funniest developments is allegations flying back between the CIA and the House Intelligence Committee. Apparently, they're accusing the CIA of having snooping on congressional intelligence staffers. Surprise, surprise. Anyway, this is what I call the Midianite thing. For those of you who've never heard me use the expression, it's a reference to the story of Gideon in the Old Testament, where Gideon is asked by an angel of the Lord to throw the Midianites out of Israel, the Midianites being evil-doing, horrible people. And what happens is the Midianites end up jumping up in the dark and killing each other. And we're watching more and more of the Midianite thing happening. Part of the squabble in the Ukraine is the centralized systems are absolutely doing the Midianite thing. But we're seeing it all over the place. We're seeing it certainly in Congress. And I think the more and more revelations that come out from all sorts of things, it's part of the nature of the online world. The more you're going to see the Midianite thing happening. So keep watching for it. The problem Congress has is that unemployment calls for serious reengineering. If you're really going to deal with the unemployment issue, you have to go at this at a much deeper and more structural level. And to do it, you need support from the Black Budget Group, because part of the problem is you've got very unsustainable economics. You keep harvesting the system, and that harvest goes out but doesn't invest in something that produces a sort of economic yield back. So it's back to the tapeworm and the drain. So the question is, how are you going to get the Black budget forces and constituencies to help re-engineer to something that's positive? If you've ever seen Charlie Ferguson's documentary on Iraq, No End in Sight, that group tends not to be into re-engineering in a wealth-building way, but engineering in the let's wreck everything and then it'll be easier to control it way. It's what inspired my article, The American Tapeworm, as I said, that I wrote in 2003, about centralizing wealth in a manner that reduces the overall returns in the ecosystem. Speaking of the tapeworm, Warren Buffett apparently likes my stuff, because he keeps using the expression financial tapeworm in attacking the public pension funds he did in his new shareholder report. He called them a financial tapeworm, which I don't agree with. But I bring that up to say that the attacking of the system on the public pension funds, the war continues to get more and more verbose. There are a lot of players who want control of that capital. It's still a very rich pot of capital, and one that creates a lot of strength on the ground in the broad middle class. So if you want to control, the problem is, it gives too many people too much financial security. Not to say that there aren't some problems with the public pensions, mostly on the healthcare side, not so much on the retirement benefit side. There are endless limited hangouts going back and forth, but every once in a while you get some very excellent writing about why the attacks are absolutely not grounded in sound reality or facts. And I put one up this week: the anti-pension billionaire shows the 5 rules of deceptive native advertising. So it was a very good piece on the sort of dirty tactics of the let's go get the public pension fund crowd. There's a lot to say about the employment issue, and I want to start talking about it some more on the Salieri Report. So we're going to have John Williams from Shadow Stats in 2 weeks, so I'll defer until that time. And of course, we won't begin to complete the employment issue with that one Salieri report, because as I said, this is a major and deep structural issue, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. There are stories of disruptive technology everywhere. I keep putting them up on the blog. It's hard to keep up with them. A great one this week was about Alipay, which is an arm of Alibaba, and what Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba, is doing to the Chinese banking system. It's called High Interest Web Banks on the Rise in China. And sometimes it's easier to see that disruptive technology working on the other side of the world than in your own society. The other one, also up on the blog, is Kickstarter passed $1 billion in pledges recently. And so they sent out some very interesting material celebrating that fact. And I think it's fantastic, because essentially what they're saying is, okay, you, the SEC, you, the federal regulators, you, the whole financial system, you make it impossible for the little guy to finance equity in each other's small businesses and startups. No problem. We just won't even bother with ownership interest. We'll just start giving each other our money and we'll build equity, you know, completely by the pay it forward method. And sure enough, we got $1 billion flying around, flying between people. And I've participated in a couple of Kickstarter projects and some other crowdfunding that are not on Kickstarter. There's a lovely new one on just science and engineering projects, and I just posted that up on the blog. The Bitcoin story evolves. Newsweek claims to have found the inventor, who is an LA former defense contractor with a very impressive resume. And of course, the market is reverberating from the latest round of hackings. It's interesting because I was yet again stunned by much of this early support for Bitcoin, because I think that if you've never been involved in a very significant way in financial transactions, particularly very large financial transactions, it's very hard to understand what is involved in creating integrity and the extraordinary efforts that are required to create integrity within a payment transaction system. The number of things that can go wrong, particularly in a world of economic warfare. I'm reminded of the wonderful song from the gospel tune, and where he says, "You're playing with the big boys now." Well, a lot of the people who thought, that running a Bitcoin exchange was just something you could get together and do, and you wouldn't have the most powerful forces in the world playing around with you for a variety of reasons, I think they know differently now. We even have a report of the CEO of one exchange in Singapore said to commit suicide. Who knows what happened? But that story is up on the blog. Bringing integrity to a financial and transaction system is much, much harder than as I said, most folks imagine. And so it's very important, before you poo-poo the American financial system, we need to remember that even though it's had many failures and it is very misused, particularly since the black budget got going, it has also had many successes as well. And we need to certainly take the good before we just say, oh, it's all fraudulent. Unfortunately, what I've found is that many of the big financial institutions I can trust a lot more that I can trust with most of my neighbors in terms of financial integrity and transaction integrity. That's a sad state of affairs, but part of what we need to do if we're going to come up with real solutions is we need to learn how to create and maintain transactional integrity just with each other and away from the big financial institutions. Markets, gold and silver have started to peak up a little bit. Silver was, which has lagged behind gold, is peaking up. Now, that just takes it back to where it was in the fall. And, of course, we're in what should be the strong time of the year. Commodities peaking up. So I was very excited to be able to interview Don Cox this week. That interview is up on the blog. Terrific interview. Terrific guy. Cox is always insightful and lively. He's one of my favorite commentators, certainly on commodities. The S&P continues to hit new highs, as I said. The ducks are squawking, and the politicians absolutely want to feed them. There's even a little life in the emerging markets, and I think part of it is the commodities picking up is helping them, because many of the emerging markets are very tied to the commodities market and, of course, always what's happening with China. The big question we asked with Don Cox, of course, is where are the earnings going to come from? And, of course, that brings us full circle to Ukraine and the brutal game of inspiring privatization by busting people's access to the capital and financial markets. Special report this week on the foreign financial reporting requirements of the U.S. Treasury for those of you who have offshore bank accounts or something like a gold money account. It's very, very important to be aware of that report, and that special report is up on the blog for subscribers. I would say nothing material has changed this year, but the manner in which It's a different form, different filing process, so you just want to look into the nuts and bolts of that. That report is up on the blog. And a very interesting Financial Times copycat article that's posted up on the blog, The New Market Space, Billionaire Investors Look Beyond Earth, and it reads remarkably like our annual wrap-up. The symmetry is inexplicable. Anyway. Our hero this week is a wonderful man who I have just learned about because of the movie that we're doing this week on Let's Go to the Movies, which is the PBS series Music Makes a City about the Louisville Orchestra. And the Charlie Farnsley was the mayor of Louisville who had such an important hand in developing and supporting the Louisville Orchestra and becoming literally the leading orchestra in the country, if not the world, in modern music. Literally going around the world and sponsoring and funding some of the top new composers around the world and writing new pieces. It's an extraordinary story of the contribution of art and culture to making a place great, including the health of the economy. I think there's a tremendous relationship between art and culture and the strength of an economy. And watching Mayor Farnsley help to support and build the Louisville Orchestra is an inspiring story. Anyway, so it got me very interested in looking into Charlie Farnsley. And one of the things I discovered is he started a press on sort of Southern culture and Southern literature called Lost Cause Press. And then I discovered that he had invented or created one of my favorite whiskeys in the world, Rebel Yell Whiskey. And even better, he was a lawyer by training. After he was mayor, he went back to practicing law, but then ran for Congress, was up in Congress for 2 years. While he was there, he contributed to the creation of the National Endowment of the Arts. But after 2 years, refused to run again, quit and went back to Louisville, wanted nothing to do with Washington. Any man who can accomplish the things that he accomplished, I say, is an incredible Renaissance man. And it's a wonderful story. When you look at his whole life history, it proves that one person can make an enormous difference in a very real way to the health and wealth of their community and society. It's a very interesting story of leadership. Let me jump just ahead to the movie itself. Music Makes a City is the PBS documentary, and it's about the significant contribution that the Louisville Orchestra made to the life and economic development of Louisville. And this is a story that has not been told, I think, enough. But if you go around the country and you look at those places which have really developed strong economies, if you dig down, what you will find is that an investment of time and money in the cultural life and the artistic life is critical to that economic development. And I'm one of the places I'm always interested in is Charleston, South Carolina, which has done amazing things, I think, with the Spoleto Festival and other developments. If you look at Memphis, Tennessee, which is about an hour from where I live, and you dig in and you look at the story of Elvis Presley and what he did to kind of put Memphis on the map. And then, of course, the music that came out of Mississippi, which sort of helped support and create people like Elvis Presley. That whole tradition has contributed mightily to the health and wealth of Memphis. And certainly, of course, Nashville is now the country, the country music capital. So I'm in a state where you really see it. And of course, Louisville is Kentucky is just one state north of us. So all of these places, the rich artistic and cultural life is so, so important. And I think this was a great documentary because it really gives an example of that in a very practical way and shows you it just took a few special people to really lead that and make it happen. Anyway, check it out. Music Makes a City by coming out of PBS. Ask Catherine a few questions this week. The television shows that we see today are very different than the ones we saw 40 to 50 years ago. TV shows used to be about family values and fun, and today they're more about ego, chaos, evil, and selfishness. How much of this transition, in your opinion, has to do with the intentional programming of our minds? I find that most TV is really about programming and entrainment, although there's plenty that's just entertainment, and they're mixed together. I would say if you look at what you need to be successful in where the economy is going, you need very high learning speeds, you need to understand what's really going on, and more importantly, you need to learn collaborative skills, sort of an attitude, a positive attitude in terms of working with other people and finding ways of building alignment. And of course, what does TV teach? It's the opposite. It teaches and encourages low learning speeds in most cases. There's some wonderful and remarkable exceptions to that. I certainly don't want to denigrate them. It teaches a lot of divide and conquer. It teaches people to feel like victims. It teaches people, you know, the opposite of collaboration. And you certainly, you know, whatever an entrepreneurial attitude is, it's rare you find it on TV. Again, some very wonderful and notable exceptions. And of course, you have all the entrainment that comes with a lot of different kinds of media. So I just think, you know, we all have the ability to turn it off. I don't own a TV. I haven't owned a TV since 1984, with the exception of when I worked in the administration, a decorator bought one for me without my consent. Said I couldn't work in the Bush administration without a TV, but I gave it away when I left. So, you know, we all have the ability to just turn it off. And I think part of what we're talking about here on the Solari Report today and always is, how do we build a strong immunity to these things? And part of it is seeing it for what it is and then turning it off. There are plenty of other, we all enjoy entertainment. There are plenty of other ways to get entertained that can minimize the amount of the entrainment and the programming you have to take in. I was born here in the United States and have lived here my entire life. America's much more clueless, blind, and trusting of their own government than people from other countries around the world seem to be. Please don't attack Americans. It's so easy to get frustrated and then start blaming Americans. There are over 300 million people resident in the United States of America. There are many different fact patterns, many different groups. I will say this, there's less literacy about the economy and the ecosystem, financial ecosystem. You know, a lot more is spent here to create and educate false frames and to threaten people who don't go along with the false frames. You know, I think the question says to me, you may not understand the extent of the soft weapons that get used and the fact that most people want to live their lives. They really don't want to have a fight with the Mr. Global and the American tapeworm. So I just think it's a much deeper issue, and I think there are plenty of people who know what's going on but understand how dangerous it is to say anything, and certainly to say anything to strangers. Okay, perhaps too late for the interview. How does the Farm Bill commodity subsidy affect the commodity market in broad terms? The recently passed 2014 Farm Bill is a mixed bag. The five-year bill is worth nearly $1 trillion and includes funds for programs like nutrition, farmers insurance, agricultural research, commodity subsidies, and conservation. 79% of the bill funds the SNAP program, food stamps, and nutrition education. And of the 21% other part of the pie, 68% funds commodities and crop insurance. Very important legislative package and appropriations. So thanks for pointing that out. The U.S. farm subsidy programs are designed to create a huge amount of a few crops, mainly five main crops, and that's designed to make sure that the United States can compete globally and provide a significant amount of what looks like calories, you know, that you and I may not think are the highest quality. But it's designed to create a centralized agricultural juggernaut, which it has done. Next question. And this was on the article called Support Your Local Slaughterhouse. Wonderful article by Bill Nyman's wife on the importance of if we're going to build a healthy food system, having local slaughterhouses under our control that we can trust. Very important point, and very few people understand how much sort of putting the local slaughterhouses out of business has been essential to sort of centralizing control of the meat supply. One of the subscriber posts, the comment, we all know this. We suspect it is some kind of effort to herd, sorry about the pun, business towards much bigger, gigantic corporate facilities as well as shut down our local producers. It makes no sense otherwise. Yes, indeed. Centralization, control of the food supply. Another person asked me if I've ever seen a website on called theweatherspace.com. It has maps for electromagnetic patterns from HARP, I believe it is, and also chemtrail forecasts. I plan to watch it daily, looking for patterns as I do earthquakes. Seeing patterns of earthquakes in areas of geopolitical unrest has been eye-opening. Yes, the correlation between earthquakes and places where, you know, that are being targeted for the kind of harvesting we're seeing in the Ukraine are very eye-opening. Haiti is the one of the more recent and painful examples. Weird weather, if there is, you know, I haven't mentioned it till now, but all of North America has been struggling mighty with unbelievably strange weather patterns. As I said in the last annual wrap-up and the one before, weird weather is going to be a major trend. It's certainly been that way for the last 2 months. I posted a commentary up on the blog early this week. On Sunday, we started the day at 6 a.m. at 64 degrees in Hickory Valley, Tennessee. By the evening, it was 34 degrees, and by 2 a.m., it was 12 degrees. And that's, you know, in early March. Doesn't make any sense. Last comment posted this week. I'm extremely pleased that news of your establishment came my way. The mental, emotional, and spiritual nutrition you're offering is a real treat. Thank you. Thank you. Our interview, as I said, we've already posted. It's an interview with Don Cox, who is the head of Cox Advisors in Chicago. He's somebody I've been listening to for years and years and years. He's the advisor to a series of commodities funds in the U.S., Canada. He's originally from Canada and internationally. Cox's conference call briefings are so popular that people just started transcribing them and passing them around the internet, which is how I first learned about him many years ago, I think about 2005. He's somebody who can understand the economy from the boots on the ground of a farmer. He grew up on a farm, but a miner or operator. He understands the economy, certainly the overt economy, at a completely micro detailed level, but can relate it to hot money shifting around the world. So his breadth of knowledge and of history is remarkable. And it was a fascinating interview. And I strongly recommend it to you because this is a guy who really does understand an enormous amount about both sides of the balance sheet globally, but he is also just a delightful human being and a delightful person to talk about. Always insightful and always helps us understand what's going on, and always inspires me whenever I talk to Don or listen to him. I'm inspired to get up and go back in and do something useful the next day. You know, I don't know why he's an anecdote for all the corruption. Just a remarkable, always inspires me to get up the next day and try harder. In closing, I did last week the Breakaway Economy Part 1, which was about who is the breakaway economy. And then next week, Part 2 is going to be about what it is, where the money's going to flow, what's going to be important, what to watch for. And then March 20th, as I said, we have employment statistics with John Williams. John has done the most significant job of tracking, breaking down the statistics, and helping us take the official statistics and dig deeper and see what's really going on. So until next week with the Breakaway Economy Part 2, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.